This is Ozarks at Large for Monday, September 30th, 2013. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Ozarks at Large is sponsored in part by the University of Arkansas Women's Giving Circle, whose mission is to transform and expand women's giving to university programs and research through a collective voice. Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, we meet Leliza Leilon, an emerging Ozarks Marshallese community organizer. Plus, we talk to David E. Casto, author of Arkansas Late in the Civil War, which has been published by the History Press. Also, the latest installment of Arkansongs, Roby Brock has his weekly business news recap, and more. But first, the bipartisan plan crafted by the Arkansas legislature to use federal Medicaid dollars to buy private health insurance was officially approved Friday. Matt DeCampbell, spokesman for Governor Mike Beebe, says it came from the head of the Federal Department of Health and Human Services.
Secretary Kathleen Sebelius called Governor Beebe to tell him that our Medicaid waiver request that we needed that waiver to get the Arkansas private option to become a reality. That waiver request had been approved. It's a done deal, and we can move forward with the Arkansas private option, and Arkansans can begin to sign up for it on Tuesday the 1st when the health insurance marketplace opens.
DeCampbell says the approval from the feds came as no surprise.
Every indication we had gotten from the federal government was that the approval was coming because we had been working so closely with them throughout this entire process. We took nothing for granted, but to get it today and to get it before October 1st are both very good pieces of news for Arkansas and for the people who will benefit from these insurance policies.
Hundreds of thousands of Arkansans are expected to sign up for coverage through the private option. DeCampbell also says the potential shutdown of the federal government won't have any impact on the insurance marketplace. The city of Bentonville will give away compost and wood mulch between the hours of 8 a.m. and 4 p.m. from tomorrow through Saturday at the city compost facility located on Northwest A Street. For a $25 loading fee, city workers will be available with skid steer and wheel loaders to assist those wanting to load pickups and trailers less than 108 inches in height. Those wanting less than one half of a cubic yard of mulch or compost, or those who aren't using a pickup or trailer, will need to bring their own containers and a shovel to load their own. A portion of Highway 41 in Franklin County will be closed for the next month. The Arkansas Highway and Transportation Department announced Friday that the highway will be closed between Highways 398 and 298. The closure is expected to last from today through November 4th, while crews repair the driving surface of a bridge on Highway 41. A detour will be in place using Highways 22, 23, and 288. Also in the River Valley, work on Interstate 540 has necessitated a traffic pattern change on Interstate 540 in Fort Smith. The change, taking effect after 8 o'clock this evening, will affect traffic between Kelly Highway in Fort Smith and Highway 59 in Van Buren. Traffic will be diverted to and from the southbound lanes by temporary median crossings, and northbound traffic will be separated from traffic heading south by a temporary concrete barrier. Temporary ramps will allow continued access at all interchanges. The average retail price of gasoline in Arkansas dropped nearly 6 cents over the course of the past 7 days. According to GasBuddy.com, a website that tracks the price of gasoline at 1,826 gas outlets in Arkansas, the price per gallon averaged $3.16 yesterday, 5.6 cents lower than 1 week before. Including the price change during the last week, gas prices yesterday were more than 42 cents per gallon lower than they were 1 year ago, and 25.5 cents per gallon lower than 1 month ago. The University of Arkansas volleyball team had a successful opening weekend of Southeastern Conference play. The Razorbacks swept Ole Miss in 3 sets in Oxford, Mississippi. Then moving on to Starksville, Mississippi, the team swept Mississippi State in 3 sets. With the pair of wins, Arkansas has a 2-0 record in conference play, and the team improves to 9-4 on the season. The Razorbacks return to Fayetteville this week for a Wednesday night match against Missouri at Barnhill Arena. The Razorback soccer team was also on the road over the weekend. In its SEC road opener, the Razorbacks shut out 14th-ranked Kentucky 3-0. It was the team's third win ever over a ranked opponent, and it was the team's 5th shutout of the season. But moving on to Columbia, South Carolina yesterday, the Razorbacks were on the other end of a shutout, losing to 20th-ranked South Carolina 1-0. With the weekend's play behind them, the Razorbacks are 1-2 in conference play and 8-3 on the season. Play continues Friday when the Razorbacks host LSU before playing host to Mississippi State Sunday at Razorback Field in Fayetteville. Tonight, mostly cloudy with lows in the 60s. Partly sunny tomorrow with highs from 82 in northwest Arkansas to 86 in the Arkansas River Valley. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy with lows around 64 degrees in northwest Arkansas to 69 degrees in the Arkansas River Valley. This is Ozarks at Large. A hostile takeover bid threatens an Arkansas trucking firm once again. Roby Brock from our content partner Talk Business Arkansas has the details.
Van Buren-based USA Truck on Thursday rejected a $242 million buyout bid from Phoenix-based Knight Transportation. The company's board of directors turned down its second unsolicited bid in the last 2 years, but Knight Transportation has vowed to take the issue directly to shareholders. In a statement, USA Truck said Knight was misleading in its disclosure of the offer. Knight said in its public announcement of the offer that it desired a satisfactory response to its request. USA Truck said it had offered to meet privately with Knight to discuss the issue. Governor Mike Beebe, state lawmakers, and public school stakeholders have been holding nonstop meetings and conversations all week long in an effort to find common ground for a potential stopgap to a $58 million insurance deficit and skyrocketing premiums for nearly 47,000 public school employees in Arkansas. House Speaker Davy Carter said that he would like to see a working draft of a bill by October 4th to start discussions for a possible special session. A report commissioned by the Northwest Arkansas Council and compiled by the University of Arkansas Center for Business and Economic Research showed that employment in Northwest Arkansas grew by 3% from 2011 to 2012, a rate that outstripped the growth rate in peer regions, the state, and the nation. Other highlights from the report included: in 2011 and 2012, the number of businesses established in the region grew slowly after declining in 2009 and 2010. Research expenditures at the University of Arkansas increased 12.7% from 2007 to 2010. A $68 million renovation to the Robinson Center Music Hall in Little Rock is on the table. The theater was built in 1939 and renovated in the 1970s. Backer said on Tuesday that it's time for another update. The performance area would be reconfigured to make it more intimate. Backstage, the theater would add space and make it easier for touring productions to set up. State business, education, and policy leaders met in Little Rock to discuss strategies for deploying more broadband throughout Arkansas. The Connecting Arkansas Internet Conference, spearheaded by Connect Arkansas, featured state and national speakers. Education officials are focused on finding ways to boost broadband access to nearly 460,000 Arkansas K-12 students. Governor Mike Beebe has pushed two working groups to formulate public-private solutions to upgrade high-speed offerings for schools and communities across the state. The groups have been meeting since earlier this summer. I'm Roby Brock, and that is your Talk Business Arkansas update.
Support for Talk Business Arkansas on Ozarks at Large is provided by Mitchell Williams Law, providing strategic counsel on a variety of sophisticated legal matters since 1954. Mitchell Williams Law Firm combines decades of diverse professional experience to clients across the U.S. Today, the firm employs nearly 80 attorneys from 4 offices in Arkansas, Texas, and New York. Online at MitchellWilliamsLaw.com. Next on Ozarks at Large, Jacqueline Froelich introduces us to Melisa Leilon, an emerging Ozarks Marshallese community organizer.
Since they first arrived more than 30 years ago, thousands of migrants from the Republic of the Marshall Islands have settled in the Arkansas and Missouri Ozarks to find work and enroll their children in public school. Islanders are able to move here with just a passport under a compact of free association with the RMI. The U.S. maintains strategic military operations in the Marshalls, stemming from a decade of Cold War nuclear weapons testing there. Portions of the island nation remain uninhabitable, and the population study shows continue to suffer health effects from radiation exposure. Despite those sacrifices, islanders who arrive here, says Marshallese advocate Melisa Leyland, find themselves ostracized.
It was very shocking to me. I didn't know that, you know, I could be categorized and classified as this group being seen as not yet assimilated into the bigger culture or bigger population.
Back home, her culture is very diverse, and Marshallese are tightly woven, living in big extended families, gathering for special festivals, and enjoying lots of sports and seaside recreation. In fact, where Melisa Leyland grew up, on Majuro Atoll, she was surrounded by water.
The length of it is 30 miles long, and the widest part of it is about 2 miles wide. So you can stand in the middle of the road, in the middle of the city, and look both ways, and you can see the lagoon side, and you look the other way around, you know, you see the other part of the ocean. So it's very tiny, and of course it's very, very overcrowded.
Very crowded, and work jobs are hard to come by, with two-thirds of the country's population of 55,000 concentrated on Majuro and Kwajalein, a U.S. military base. Unemployment hovers around 36%. Many islanders struggle with chronic disease due to poor diet, as well as lack of access to clean water and electricity. Alcoholism is pervasive. As a certified court interpreter, the only one in the state of Arkansas, Melisa Leyland has assisted numerous islanders here arrested for drinking in public.
The system here is completely different from what we're used to back home. For anyone just to drink maybe two cans of beer and walk on the street, and that's perfectly normal. Here they call that, you know, public intoxication.
To help islanders better assimilate, local health and social welfare advocates operating as gaps in service to Marshallese based in Springdale distribute handbooks in the native language on what to expect when moving to Arkansas. And they'll also discover that due to their unique migrant status, islanders are prevented from receiving entitlements like Medicaid, ARKIDS, and Social Security, even though such taxes are deducted from their paychecks. That's why Melisa Leyland and others have been encouraging the Arkansas delegation to extend entitlements to them.
We are a legal resident. We do have a unique status due to the terms in the Compact of Free Association. And we do contribute just like anyone else. We pay state taxes and federal taxes just like anyone else.
But Melisa Leyland is not like everyone else back home, being descended from Marshallese royalty. Prior to historic colonial incursion, her island nation was matrilineal, governed by powerful clan leaders. And the two-class system is still in place, comprised of royalty and commoners. But rather than dwelling on her lineage, Melisa Leyland has chosen to serve first by enlisting in the U.S. Army after passing a rigorous entrance exam when she was just 18.
I can speak for myself. When I found out, it was like, I'm gone. And I would think, you know, that would be the same case with younger generation. They would, because really, if you think about it, there's really not much opportunities offer back home.
After basic training in Fort Jackson, South Carolina, she was stationed in Korea for several years, then Germany, ending her 10-year military service as active guard reserve in Chicago.
Well, when I was in Chicago, I found out that there was a substantial population of Marshallese here. So I applied at University of Arkansas, and I got accepted there, and I came here.
That was 2005. She's been here ever since. She's about to graduate with a degree in international business and plans to continue her education, possibly applying to law school. Plus, she's attained U.S. citizenship, having served in the U.S. military. For now, she's focused on providing for her family. She has a young son and advocating for Ozark Islanders. According to the 2010 census, 4,300 people identified themselves specifically as Marshallese, the highest population on the continental U.S. Hawaii has long been a destination for islanders. More than 7,400 live there now. And as a consequence, Hawaii receives $13 million annually in compact impact aid to help defray health care and education costs for migrants. And even though Arkansas now has a large population of Marshallese, the state receives nothing. Melisa Leyland believes census enumerators likely missed a lot more islanders here, qualifying Arkansas for millions of dollars of compact impact aid as well.
If other states can get money out of this compact to defray, you know, immigrant costs, I think we should be getting it too.
Compact impact funding for Arkansas is currently before Congress, but packaged in with comprehensive immigration reform, so likely won't be considered this year. Melissa Leilong will continue to press for it. But in her spare time, she's working to establish the first ever Marshallese-run nonprofit organization in Arkansas.
Yeah, Arkansas Coalition of Marshallese, ACOM.
So far, she's staged a citizenship drive targeting islanders like herself who volunteered to serve in the U.S. military, conducted a children's clothing drive, built a community garden, and hosted classes on healthy cooking. In the near future, the Arkansas Coalition of Marshallese is partnering with the University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences in securing grant funding to conduct health outreach initiatives in the Marshallese community, hiring a full-time Islander staff person. But most of all, Melisa Leyland encourages Rilakkin, foreigners like us, to understand a little bit about Marshallese history and culture.
You know, take time to learn about me. I have taken my time to learn about you. You can't judge people based on, you know, just their looks and what you've heard in the past. We work hard just like anyone else. We're people. We move here. We migrate this way to look for that American dream. So we're no different from anyone else.
A good place to start is rmiembassyus.org. Click on the culture link. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
For more information, you can contact Melisa at 283-2992 or email her at melaelan@uark.edu.
And that's when we realized we had overlooked one small but very important detail. We forgot to ask Sandra which bedroom window was hers.
I've been sheltered all my life by the humane practice of courtship and romantic etiquette. I was unprepared for how the rest of the animal world likes to go about love.
Flicks his wrist, sending the eggs up into the air into two perfectly laid out slow motion backflips. But something goes terribly wrong.
Tales from the South, Saturday afternoon at 3:30 on KUAF.
It is Monday, September 30th, 2013, and this is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda, and joining me now is Becca Martin Brown, features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Giving all the parents out there a heads up for something happening October 20th.
Okay.
VeggieTales Live.
I love VeggieTales.
I still remember how upset Amanda's father got over the hairbrush song.
Why?
Could have been the fact he didn't have any hair. That we all sang it to him all day after we saw them live.
It's an excellent song.
Anyway, this touring production is called Happy Birthday, Bob and Larry, and it celebrates 20 years of VeggieTales.
That many?
Yes.
Wow.
Happening at 2 p.m. on October 20th at the Fort Smith Convention Center, and you can find tickets at VeggieTales.com/live. Oh, and there is a meet and greet available.
Perfect. Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin Brown is features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Oh, where is my hairbrush? Oh, where is my hairbrush? Oh, where, 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 oh, where is my hairbrush?
Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. The first serve annual tennis tournament is October 4th through 6th at Summerhill Athletic Club in Fayetteville. This Northwest Arkansas Free Health Center fundraiser supports medical, dental, and pharmaceutical services for the uninsured and those in need. Registration and more information are available at nwafhc.org. This is Ozarks at Large. The Civil War battles of Pea Ridge and Prairie Grove were fought in this part of the state in the first half of the conflict. Later, during the war, many battles and skirmishes took place further south, and many of those battles included violent guerrilla-type action. David E. Casto has compiled information about the war in central and southern Arkansas in 1864 and 1865. His book, Arkansas Late in the Civil War, has just been published by the History Press. Recently, Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums talked to David Casto about the book and the ancestor of David's in the Union Army that inspired him to start his research.
I knew when I was 7 or 8 years old that there was another David Casto, and he had been a Union cavalryman in Company G, 8th Missouri Cavalry, you know, and my grandpa, he told me just a few little bits and pieces of stories about him, you know, and the war, and it fired my imagination, you know, and they planted the seeds of something in me that never left, obviously, you know.
And it's interesting, the 8th Missouri that he was in, those were young men who were used to sort of the Ozark Plateau, and they end up late in the Civil War in a place that's not at all like what they were used to.
Yeah, they spent most of the war in eastern and central Arkansas, you know, in the White River Valley and the Arkansas River Valley. They did venture up into the Ozark foothills a little bit, but for the most part, they were in the book takes place. You could draw a line from Little Rock to Duval's Bluff, and up to Augusta, and over to Searcy, then back down to Little Rock. There's kind of a triangle area there. That was like the cockpit of their war, and it was, yeah, you're right, it was very different from the Ozark Plateau, Springfield, Missouri area, southwestern Missouri.
And it took that initially took its toll on some of the soldiers.
Oh, it took its toll throughout the war. It did. They lost men continually to disease and sickness. I mean, they didn't all die, but once men had gotten sick, they were introduced to the hospital. It's like once they were introduced to that hospital, they never quite got well. Men would be discharged. And then two or three months later, they would be back in the hospital for a while. Then they would be discharged from the hospital. Then in a couple of months, back in the hospital again. And then stuff like that, you know, affected men for the rest of their lives. They never, you know, I've seen examples of soldiers, they never got over the sicknesses they picked up in Arkansas.
We're in this part of Arkansas, of course, in the northwest corner. We're very familiar with Pea Ridge and Prairie Grove. That was earlier than what takes place and north and west of what takes place in Arkansas late in the Civil War. What was that triangle that you described? What was it like in 1864, 1865?
Well, when the Union Army took Little Rock, they held the line of the Arkansas River from Pine Bluff, Little Rock, and smaller river towns, and then Fort Smith. And they were pretty much content with just holding that line. And when the Confederates retreated from Little Rock, there were groups of Confederates that didn't retreat. They stayed north of the Arkansas River. And they were fairly disorganized in late 1863 and early 1864. But the Confederates began to try to reinforce and organize these bands that were operating up in northeast Arkansas better. And that's pretty much how the war was, pretty much just a guerrilla conflict. These stay-behind rebels would come out of the woods and the swamps, and they would shoot at the railroad, they'd shoot at trains, they'd shoot at the picket outposts and then try to get out before they were caught. I said in the book, it resembled the Vietnam War more than it did the Civil War as it was fought back east. But then in the spring of 1864, the war began to heat up in central Arkansas for the simple fact that Joe Shelby's Confederate Iron Brigade crossed the Arkansas River at Dardanelle, and he rode around the Union Army into Batesville, and he set up shop in Batesville for the express purpose of making the Union life miserable in central Arkansas. He was to attack the supply line along the White River, which was very important. There was a stretch of railroad between DeVos Bluff and Little Rock that was a lifeline to the Union Army. And his sole purpose was to keep them on their toes and keep attacking the supply lines, keep their attention drawn to him so Sterling Price could eventually start north with his army and invade Missouri. So in the spring and summer and late summer of 1864, they were chasing Joe Shelby around central Arkansas quite a bit.
He's a fascinating character. You write that he had led pro-slavery raids into Kansas?
Well, you know, the Civil War began along the Missouri-Kansas border in the 1850s, before Fort Sumter was fired on in 1861. There was a lot of cross-border raids. You know, the Kansas Free Staters would raid into Missouri and steal slaves and create mayhem. The pro-slavery forces in Missouri would raid into Missouri and try to inflict harm on them. It was a very lawless situation along the Missouri-Kansas border in the 1850s, and Shelby took part in that.
And he had no formal military training, is that correct?
Yes.
But he became formidable.
Oh yeah, he was one of the, you know, if he's one of those guys that if he had been on the east side of the Mississippi River, he would have ended up with a major command. As it was, I think he was a colonel for a large part of the war. I think maybe it was 18. I'm not an expert on Shelby himself, but I think in 1864 he got his brigadier general star. But he was a very innovative, successful general.
A general who is mentioned in the book Arkansas Late in the Civil War, a man who eventually becomes general, is Eugene Asa Carr, and that's where he was connected to your great-grandfather.
Yeah. You know, I mentioned in the book that even as a kid, I knew my great-grandpa served under General Carr. And, I kind of knew about him. Over the years, I picked up a biography of Carr that was written in 1963, probably for the Civil War centennial. And it just actually just barely touches on his time his time in Arkansas. Of course, the Battle of Pea Ridge was mentioned quite prominently. He would be awarded a Medal of Honor for his actions at Pea Ridge. But the events of 1864 and 1865 are barely mentioned in his biography. And I found Carr to be an interesting character, equally interesting, like Joe Shelby was.
You know, reading this book, you just get the sense that it would be so hard to know exactly what was happening in this situation. We should point out, too, that the 8th Missouri, as they're patrolling this territory, their numbers have been diminished by order of General Grant.
What happened was in the spring of 1864, Grant ordered Frederick Steele, the commander of the Union Army in Little Rock, to undertake what would become the Camden Expedition. He was supposed to, there was a big expedition coming up the Red River in Louisiana, and Grant wanted Steele to reinforce it from Arkansas. And Frederick Steele didn't want to do this because he knew he couldn't haul enough supplies to get his men and animals through South Arkansas into North Missouri. The area had already been picked over by the Confederate Army. There just wasn't any forage or food there. And he didn't want to do this, but he was ordered to. So he took about half the troops in the state with him on this Camden expedition. And actually, in May of 1864, he had got down in Camden, and he realized he couldn't go any further. And he turned around and he headed back to Little Rock. His army was just out of food, and they were being nipped at constantly by the Confederate cavalry. And the Confederates had beaten the Union Army in Louisiana, and they had turned three infantry divisions around and were heading to Steele at Camden. He said, he knew he couldn't stay and fight this many troops, so he headed back to Little Rock, and they fought the battle. That's where the Battle of Jenkins Ferry was fought on that campaign. So Steele took a lot of troops with him, but he returned in May of 1864.
It's still hard for me to wrap my imagination around the fact that there would be battles on the White River with gunboats.
Oh yeah, there was the White River was a very important supply line. It was more important than the Arkansas River. because the Arkansas River at that time was so broad and shallow, it was very difficult to get boats up the Arkansas. It was hard to get them up to Little Rock, and getting them beyond Little Rock, you know, the farther you went, the harder it got. And then there was only, you know, maybe just 3 months out of the year they might get a boat all the way up to Fort Smith. And the White River is, I guess, kind of a narrower, deeper river, and at least up till, you know, somewhere like up to Augusta anyway, maybe up to Batesville. So boats would go up the White River, and they'd deposit their goods at Duval's Bluff. Of course, the railroad, they would load then the goods on the railroad and ship them down the railroad to Little Rock, and then they would be freighted to the outlying posts. So, that was a constant activity, this movement of supplies and then guarding these wagon trains and the Confederates trying to ambush them and fight them and so forth. It was just a constant thing that went on. That's one thing I've heard from people that, you know, people that have read it have told me that they didn't realize the level of the conflict in central Arkansas.
Well, and gunboats. I mean, and these were modern tin-clad battleships, more or less.
Yeah. They would take these light draft riverboats and then put steel plating around the bottom decks and put guns on them and make them into gunboats. And, yeah, there was a lot of gunboat activity in Arkansas too, up the White and the Arkansas River. I mentioned this in the book, it was the first modern war in many respects. You had the use of the telegraph, and everything that was modern about it you found in Arkansas: the use of the telegraph, the use of railroad to move men and supplies, the use of the iron gunboats, the iron ships, and the use of repeating arms. You know, all of this was found in Arkansas.
You have pictures, there are photographs in the book of, I think, the Tyler, which was a gunboat, and also the Queen City.
Mm-hmm.
I'm surprised at how many clear, crystal clear images there are, especially of the officers.
Yeah. Well, you know, that was a big thing. There's no shortage of photographs, especially from the Union Army, because they had Duval's Bluff and Little Rock, you know, the big towns, and they all got, seemed like they all, many of them got their pictures taken. And I went to different sources, of course, the Arkansas History Commission and the UALR Center for Arkansas Studies. They provided me with a lot of photographs. And the Wilson's Creek Battlefield National Park had a lot of the actual photographs of the 8th Missouri men and officers that I have in the book.
Was there anything you wanted to be able to find, or any information that you just couldn't, that's been lost to history?
Oh, well, yeah. I guess I don't know what's...
Right.
I don't know what I didn't find, but I was never satisfied with the amount of information. I constantly dug and looked for more, and I'm convinced I found just about everything I could. You know, I mean, that's out there, you know.
When you were a youngster and you were hearing some of the stories or some of the things from your grandfather,
mm-hmm.
and the let's see, your grandfather would have been the son of David Cass?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you're,
yeah.
Yeah. So you're hearing those stories. And at that time, I think you write that your grandparents lived south of Atkins?
Mm-hmm.
So this Arkansas, you know, was a Confederate state, and I just wonder, what was the sort of sense of that history or pride or whatever in what your father had done?
You know, I gathered that my grandpa was pretty proud of his dad. I know my dad was proud of his grandpa being a Union soldier, and it wasn't. I can tell you, when I was a little kid and I heard he was a Union soldier, I kind of thought, well, that's not right. But, you know, because Arkansas is a southern state, I don't think I quite understood it at the time. But, you know, that's something obviously I got over. But, you know, as far as Arkansas being a southern state, it wasn't that cut and dried, you know, in the South. There were pockets of Unionism all over the South. And just like there were pockets of Confederate sympathy in some of the northern border states, you know, Indiana and Illinois had pockets of Confederate sympathizers.
The name of the book is Arkansas Late in the Civil War. David E. Casto, thank you so much for your time.
All right. Well, thank you.
David E. Casto's new book is Arkansas Late in the Civil War. He talked to Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums from his home in Maumelle. This is Ozarks at Large. 50 years ago, Birmingham, Alabama was a tense city. The segregated South was on full display. The nation was watching the civil rights struggle on the nightly news. And in September of 1963, four girls were murdered when the 16th Street Baptist Church was bombed. The novel, The Watsons Go to Birmingham, follows a family traveling from their home in Flint, Michigan to Birmingham in the summer of 63. Christopher Paul Curtis's book won several accolades, including a Newbery Honor and the Coretta Scott King Award. Now the book is a film, and tonight it will be screened for free at Bentonville High School. Tanya Lewis Lee is a producer and co-writer of the screenplay. She's in Northwest Arkansas for the screening, and this morning she told Ozarks at Large the book is a family favorite.
I really enjoyed reading the story out loud with my children. We literally laughed. We had some serious somber moments, and then we had a great conversation about American history. And I think, in reading that, I mean, the family just came so alive to me. I love the family dynamics, I'm someone who always has thought about how to make history interesting and relevant to young people. And so after reading the book and, talking with my producing partner, it just seemed like the right mix of family dynamic and at the same time an ability to, get a little history in a way that kids could really relate and enjoy in a sense.
In the book and the film, the Watson family heads south from Michigan to take the oldest son, Byron, to spend time with his grandmother after he gets into trouble. Tanya Lewis Lee says since Byron is unfamiliar with a segregation that didn't exist in his hometown, young readers can experience the Jim Crow South the same way Byron does.
And to tell them through the eyes of a young person, our main character, Kenny, is a 12-year-old boy, and we really get a chance to see what this world is like because it's foreign to him too when he gets down to Birmingham. So through Kenny's eyes, we are able to experience what Birmingham would be like for any of us if we were to step back in time and to see what that would feel like. So I do think that we definitely are telling this story in a unique way because we're telling it really through a child's eye.
The film premiered earlier this month on the Hallmark Channel and is now available on DVD at Walmart stores. The connection helped bring the screening to Bentonville. And is a rarity for a television landscape that includes programs like Breaking Bad and Boardwalk Empire, a positively reviewed drama that can be viewed by almost every member of the family.
And that's what's so great. And those shows that you named are really great and fun, but you're right. I don't necessarily want to watch them with my 10-year-old or even my 15-year-old. They can be very uncomfortable. But The Watsons Go to Birmingham is a real opportunity to bring families together the way when I grew up, I remember Sunday night, watching The Wonderful World of Disney with my family, and it was a really, really a moment for us to come together. And so it's just such a great opportunity to take something like The Watsons that is entertaining and then also allows families to have a conversation about who we are as a family and who we are as Americans.
She says the film and the book it is adapted from ultimately offer a chance for people to engage in conversations about a very difficult time in American history, when the city of Birmingham became known as Bombingham, and there were laws in the city that made it illegal for white people and black people to even play together.
My family is from Virginia, so my parents grew up in the segregated South. And so in reading this book, first of all, we were able to just laugh about some of Byron's crazy antics. And sort of relate in terms of some of the sibling rivalry that went on. But at the same time, I was able to talk to my kids about sort of their own personal history, what their grandparents had gone through in terms of growing up in segregation. And it's interesting. I will say this, you know, when talking to my parents about that, and I tried to make this clear in the film, you know, when they were growing up in the segregated South, they were very insulated from some of the horrors of being feeling less than. In other words, they lived in a very segregated, insular community, and only when they stepped out of that, if they had to for very specific things, were they faced with some of the difficulties of dealing with segregation. And so they really grew up in a very warm, loving, protected environment as much as possible, and yet they knew that when they stepped out of that, they had to kind of watch themselves for safety reasons. And so it was a great opportunity to have that conversation with my children.
Tanya Lewis-Lee is producer and co-writer of the screenplay of the film The Watsons Go to Birmingham, based on the book of the same name by Christopher Paul Curtis. The movie will be screened tonight at 6:30 for free at Bentonville High School and is available on DVD at Walmart stores.
From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansas Songs. Little Beaver Hale became an important and widely respected R&B guitarist, both in the studio and as a solo artist. Hale was born August 15, 1945, in Forest City in St. Francis County. Hale got the nickname Little Beaver due to his front teeth as a child, and he embraced the name. Hale similarly took up and embraced the guitar, also at a young age. '60s, Little Beaver got connected with the South Florida R&B scene. Hale became guitarist and arranger on such songs as Betty Wright's 1971 hit Clean Up Woman and other songs in Miami's TK Records and its subsidiaries. TK Records became especially notable for its early disco hits. In 1972, Little Beaver released his first solo record and album, Joey. Joey album came Little Beaver's biggest album, Party Down, and the song Party Down Part 1 in 1974. Other Little Beaver albums of the era include When Was the Last Time, Black Rhapsody, and Beaver Fever, the latter credited to Willie Beaver Hale. All were originally released on a subsidiary of TK Records called Cat, while being more recently reissued in American music-loving countries like Japan. Little Beaver played guitar in English R&B singer Joss Stone's 2003 and 2004 albums, which went multi-platinum and helped reinvigorate R&B music, especially in Europe.
Break out the red lights. Welcome to the party life. Welcome to the 70s. Sweet. On a jumper treesy while talking to this breezy. Brushing off my three-piece, I make this look too easy. So tall and lanky, my suit, it should bank me. I make it look good to be this hood, my Atlansky. Mixed with lucky lefty.
Little Beaver's riff and beat-heavy albums of the 1970s, of course, have proven ripe for sampling. Jay-Z's 2007 song Party Life, heard here, samples Beaver's Get Into the Party Life. But Little Beaver's guitar acolytes have gone beyond that. In 2002, People Under the Stairs, a hip-hop duo, sampled Hale's songs and called the tracks Sweet for Beaver Part 1 and Sweet for Beaver Part 2 in 2002. In 1986, Leo Kottke recorded an instrumental in Willie Hale's style and called it Little Beaver.
Thank you.
Neither the Little Beaver name nor that of Willie Hale made it to household name status for the average Arkansaser. But to listeners of 1970s-era R&B and early disco, Forest City-born Willie Hale, also known as Little Beaver, is on a short list of guitar heroes. From Forest City in St. Francis County, here's Arkansaser Willie Hale, better known as Little Beaver, with Get Into the Party Life from 1974.
No, nothing in the world makes me sadder than to see a lonely person. Because with all the poverty, heartbreaks and heartaches, ups and downs, phony smiles and envious frowns, there's still a lot of love and happiness to be found. All you gotta do is party down.
Little Beaver, also known as Willie Hale of Forest City, with Get Into the Party Life from 1974. It's another song of Arkansas. From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs.
Arkansongs is a production of KUAR and Experiment Station Studios. Associate producer is Keith Merks. For more information, go to arkansongs.org. Arkansongs, since 1999.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Next time on Here and Now, October brings the new Supreme Court term. On the docket this fall, there are cases involving abortion, campaign finance, affirmative action, and the separation of church and state. We will preview the term with Emily Bazelon, legal affairs editor for Slate. That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Here and Now, coming up next here on KUAF 91.3 FM. KUAF is supported by Northwest Arkansas Media, publishers of Northwest Arkansas Times, Springdale and Rogers Morning News, Benton County Daily Record, and the Arkansas Democrat Gazette. These daily newspapers offer local, state, national, and international news, plus business and Razorback news. NWAOnline.com for more information. Walton Arts Center presents Onda Union Friday, October 4th, as part of the 10x10 Arts Series. These musicians will travel across the globe to perform traditional folk music from Inner Mongolia, including throat singing and unusual instruments. Tickets and more information are available at waltonartscenter.org or 443-5600. The Illinois River Watershed Partnership and the Heart of America Artists Association are proud to present the 2013 Illinois River Salon Art Exhibition. The inaugural juried exhibition features artwork celebrating the scenic beauty of the Illinois River Watershed of Northwest Arkansas and Eastern Oklahoma. Artists are competing for more than $7,500 in awards. Award-winning works will be displayed October 3rd through the 4th during the Illinois River Watershed Partnership's 2013 National Restoration of Our Rivers Conference, being held at Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art in Bentonville. The public is invited to meet the artists at an awards ceremony and reception on October 2nd from 6 to 8 p.m. at Compton Gardens in Bentonville. Works will be for sale, and complimentary wine and cheese will be served. The Arkansas Insurance Department, in partnership with the University of Arkansas Clinton School of Public Service, will host the open enrollment kickoff tomorrow to mark the opening of the health insurance marketplace. The event is scheduled from 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. at the Clinton School. The event is free and open to the public. Tomorrow is the first day that people can view plans offered through the marketplace. Those attending the event can set up a marketplace account, shop and compare health insurance plans, and learn how much financial assistance they qualify for. Trained, licensed guides will be on hand to assist with enrollment. Attendees can also gather information from a number of informational booths. To be eligible to enroll, a person must be between the ages of 18 and 64, live in the United States, and must be a U.S. citizen or lawfully present. Anyone who plans to enroll should be prepared with birth date and Social Security numbers or document numbers for legal immigrants for each member of their household, employer and income information for every member of the household, policy numbers for any current health insurance plans covering members of your household, and a completed employer coverage tool for every job-based plan anyone in your house is eligible for. That form and a checklist can be found at healthcare.gov. Fort Smith Mayor Sandy Sanders and members of the city's board of directors will hold a town hall meeting tomorrow night, immediately following the board's regular meeting. The meeting is to hear ideas, complaints, or questions about city government. The board meeting begins at 6 and will take place at the Fort Smith Public Schools Service Center, which is located at 3205 Jenny Lynn Road in Fort Smith. A listener-supported service of the Department of Journalism and Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas, this is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, Siloam Springs. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Thanks so much for listening. Tune in tomorrow at noon for an all-new edition of Ozarks at Large. Thanks again for listening, and I hope your week is off to a fantastic start.